Tonight is New Year's Eve in America, and we bring to conclusion at the end of this year, the end of chapter 24, the evolution of the spiritual man. So, deep in the cosmic purpose, there is a will for the embedded spiritual reality to manifest itself through the coils of evolution. To enter the cosmic adventure in material form, to vivify it, to make it live, to make it think, to make it rational, to form a being which can encompass all of this is not the ultimate purpose of the universe. It wants to test farther possibilities. It wants to evolve a spiritual consciousness which knows itself deeply to its roots, which manifests itself in terms of innate powers and beauties. This means going beyond the arc which is possible to the mind. This means that we must outgrow what humanity is. We must become something more. What may we be? To inquire into the deeper possibilities, we have to have experience. We have to have a way of assessing the universe and that which is beyond the universe. So, the four ways that we know about the evolution of a spiritual consciousness are these provinces of religion and occultism and spiritual philosophy, and finally, the grounding of spiritual experience. So Sri Aurobindo has covered each one of these themes in some detail, and in our last meeting together, saw that he finds the culmination of the spiritual possibilities in the human, in the sage, in the seer, in the rishi, to be a sign of a completeness to a particular cycle in the human development that permits us to go beyond. We are ready to push beyond. So, we will take up these last few paragraphs now and see where Sri Aurobindo leads us. This, then, has been up till now the course of nature's evolution of the spiritual man and the human mental being. And it may be questioned, what is the exact sum of this achievement and its actual significance? In the recent reaction towards the life of the mind and matter, this great direction and this rare change have been stigmatized as no true evolution of consciousness, but rather a sublimated crudity of ignorance deviating from the true human evolution, which should be solely an evolution of life power, the practical physical mind, the reason governing thought and conduct, and the discovering and organizing intelligence. So this perspective would see what we call spiritual evolution as an aberration. It is a retrogression back into the foggy morbidities of mystical life. You see also that this insistence that grounding ourselves on the material basis and governing our lives with intellect essentially takes us back to chapter 2 in The Life Divine, the materialist denial. Remember, he opens with the human aspiration, then talks about the materialist denial, and then about the refusal of the ascetic. So both negative the other. So this is some of the context with which we deal. In this epoch, religion was pushed aside as an out-of-date superstition, and spiritual realization and experience discredited as a shadowy mysticism. The mystic, in this view, is the man who turns aside into the unreal, into occult regions of a self-constructed land of chimeras, and loses his way there. Chimera, again, is from the Greek, meaning something like a wild fancy or a fire-spouting monster. This judgment proceeds from a view of things which is itself bound to pass into discredit because it depends ultimately on the false perception of the material as alone real and the outward life as alone of importance. But apart from this extreme materialistic view of things, it can be and is still held by the intellect and the physical mind eager for human life fulfillment, and that is the prevalent mentality, the dominant modern trend, that the spiritual tendency in humanity has come to very little. It has not solved the problem of life, nor any of the problems with which humanity is at grips. The mystic either detaches himself from life as the otherworldly ascetic or the aloof visionary and therefore cannot help life, or else he brings no better solution or result than the practical man or the man of intellect and reason. By his intervention, he rather disturbs the human values, distorts them with his alien and unverifiable light obscure to the human understanding, and confuses the plain, practical, and vital issues life puts before us. So the disengaged mystic may have fine interior experiences, but they don't affect life. They don't really help transform things. This is the criticism that is being made. Sri Aurobindo allows it to stand until he knocks it down. But this paragraph. But this is not the standpoint from which the true significance of the spiritual evolution in man or the value of spirituality can be judged or assessed. For its real work is not to solve human problems on the past or present mental basis, but to create a new foundation of our being and our life and knowledge. The ascetic or otherworldly tendency of the mystic is an extreme affirmation of his refusal to accept the limitations imposed by material nature. For his very reason of being is to go beyond her. If he cannot transform her, he must leave her. At the same time, the spiritual man has not stood back altogether from the life of humanity. For the sense of unity with all beings, the stress of a universal love and compassion, the will to spend the energies for the good of all creatures, are central to the dynamic outflowering of the spirit. He has turned, therefore, to help. He has guided, as did the ancient rishis or the prophets, or stooped to create, and where he has done so, with something of the direct power of the spirit, the results have been prodigious. But the solution of the problem which spirituality offers is not a solution by external means, though these also have to be used, but by an inner change, a transformation of the consciousness and nature. Let's go back and read the footnote. Gita, the Buddhist elevation of universal compassion, karuna, and sympathy, vasudhaiva kutumbakam, the whole earth is my family, to be the highest principle of action, the Christian emphasis on love indicate this dynamic side of the spiritual being. In other words, moving out of the personal liberation into engagement with life to uplift others who are blinded in ignorance and hurt in suffering. And so he's just touched upon, of course, the ascetic refusal. That is not the final indictment of the spiritual consciousness, because it is possible for us to be engaged in an interchange of awareness and to extend the values of that interchange into life, affirming life, uplifting life, transforming life. So, if no decisive, but only a contributory result, an accretion of some new finer elements to the sum of the consciousness has been the general consequence, and there has been no life transformation, it is because man in the mass has always deflected the spiritual impulsion, recanted from the spiritual ideal, or held it only as a form, and rejected the inward change. Recant means to retract, revoke. So he will eventually trace the cause of this failure to change life to all three modalities. But here we see we have formalized what we mean by this change of consciousness, but have not actually lived it. Carl Jung had an insight that because we quake, perhaps, intimidated by the infinite before us, we do the infinite great honor by establishing a religion, an institution, a code of behavior to stand between us and that, so that we can regulate our approach to it and minimize its huge impact on our life, because we aren't willing to experience the infinite, really. So here it is. If we want a change of consciousness, we must confront that and be absorbed into that experience. So he continues, spirituality cannot be called upon to deal with life by a non-spiritual method or attempt to cure its ills by the panaceas, the universal cures, the political, social, or other mechanical remedies which the mind is constantly attempting and which have always failed and will continue to fail to solve anything. The most drastic changes made by these means change nothing, for the old ills exist in a new form. The aspect of the outward environment is altered, but man remains what he was. He is still an ignorant mental being, misusing or not effectively using his knowledge, moved by ego and governed by vital desires and passions and the needs of the body, unspiritual and superficial in his outlook, ignorant of his own self and the forces that drive and use him. His life constructions have a value as expressions of his individual and collective being in the stage to which they have reached, or as a machinery for the convenience and welfare of his vital and physical parts, and a field and medium for his mental growth. But they cannot take him beyond his present self, or serve as a machinery to transform him. His and their perfection can only come by his farther evolution. So here he's touched upon them all. The mind fails, vitality fails, the material approach fails. Only a spiritual change, an evolution of his being, from the superficial mental towards the deeper spiritual consciousness can make a real and effective difference. To discover the spiritual being in himself is the main business of the spiritual man, and to help others towards the same evolution is his real service to the race. Till that is done, an outward help can succor and alleviate, but nothing or very little more is possible. So, in his understated way, he has said then that it is the spiritual figures who are the real leaders of humanity. It is that illumined humanity, with its grip on the powers of life, that could potentially make a change and radically remove ignorance from the world. It is true that the spiritual tendency has been to look more beyond life than towards life. It is true also that the spiritual change has been individual and not collective. Its result has been successful in the man, but unsuccessful or only indirectly operative in the human mass. The spiritual evolution of nature is still in process and incomplete. One might almost say still only beginning. But its main preoccupation has been to affirm and develop a basis of spiritual consciousness and knowledge, and to create more and more a foundation or formation for the vision of that which is eternal in the truth of the Spirit. It is only when nature has fully confirmed this intensive evolution and formation through the individual that anything radical of an expanding or dynamically diffusive character can be expected, or any attempt at collective spiritual life. Such attempts have been made, but mostly as a field of protection for the growth of the individual's spirituality, acquire a successful permanence. This is an interesting notation. So the individual solution is often meant leaving life as we find it. But there's a purpose in that, that we have to bring to a rounded fullness what the individual can accomplish before broadcasting it more fully to the rest of waiting humanity. We have to achieve it in ourselves before it can become generalized. The idea that spiritual life can be made collective is, of course, known to us through the sanghas and ashrams, etc., but also in a way that does not reject or recoil from life when we look at the tantric systems by which spirituality is made collective in the sense of an extended family. But any attempt before there is illumination at the center is likely to fail. It cannot rest too only in one member. That light has to be transmitted and made vivid in other members of such a community. Many attempts have been made, east and west. Most have failed. Most have failed miserably. Some have failed gloriously. But there is still a need for spiritual community to advance the purpose of evolution in the cosmos. In a sense, it is the collective which represents the universal aspect of evolution. The individual represents the person, but the collective represents the mass, the all, the universe. Hmm. And I think we can look at Sri Aurobindo's couching this in a way that includes in his perspective the life of the Sri Aurobindo ashram. So he has many years, a couple of decades of experience by then, governing, in a sense, and shaping the life of those who were around him to try to live out the values of the integral yoga. Later, of course, there would be Auroville. Back to his paragraph. For till then, the individual must be preoccupied with his own problem of entirely changing his mind and life into conformity with the truth of the Spirit, which he is achieving or has achieved in his inner being and knowledge. Any premature attempt at a large-scale collective spiritual life is exposed to vitiation by some incompleteness of the spiritual knowledge on its dynamic side, by the imperfections of the individual seekers, and by the invasion of the ordinary mind and vital and physical consciousness taking hold of the truth and mechanizing, obscuring, or corrupting it. One could place a footnote here and list names and institutions and ashrams that would give wonderful examples to what he's talking about. Out of kindness, we'll move forward. The mental intelligence and its main power of reason cannot change the principle and persistent character of human life. It can only affect various mechanizations, manipulations, developments, and formulations. But neither is mind as a whole, even spiritualized, able to change it. Spirituality liberates and illumines the inner being. It helps mind to communicate with what is higher than itself, to escape even from itself. It can purify and uplift by the inner influence the outward nature of individual human beings. But so long as it has to work in the human mass through mind as the instrument, it can exercise an influence on the earth life, but not bring about a transformation of that life. So, mind based in intellect is incapable of supplying the transformation the cosmos demands. But mind spiritualized is also incapable of achieving that. So even at our best, even when the mind has been made wide, is coterminous with spiritual awareness. It isn't sufficient. It hasn't power enough to transform life. For this reason, he writes, there has been a prevalent tendency in the spiritual mind to be satisfied with such an influence and in the main to seek fulfillment in other life elsewhere or to abandon altogether any outward going endeavor and concentrate solely on an individual spiritual salvation or perfection. A higher instrumental dynamis than mind is needed to transform totally a nature created by the ignorance. So, since the awakened spiritual mind feels its incapacity to change and only to influence, it leaves it unattempted. We have to get beyond this illumined power, this instrumental dynamis higher than mind, obviously is a reference to the higher consciousness, to the supramental, to regions to and through which we must still evolve. Another objection to the mystic and his knowledge is urged. not against its effect upon life, but against his method of the discovery of truth and against the truth that he discovers. So the mystic is one who lives the inner life, who has the experience and the building realizations of which we've been speaking. So the first objection is that it hasn't really done any good. It hasn't really changed life. But spiritualized mind cannot change life. We have to evolve to the higher grade to be able to do that. Now, here comes a challenge to the very value of the experience. One objection to the method is that it is purely subjective, not true independently of the personal consciousness and its constructions, not verifiable. This would be made more powerful in argumentation later when phenomenology developed in philosophy. It was beginning to find its own argument around this time. You can imagine that Sri Aurobindo would find this particularly challenging standpoint, because this would cut against his chief reliance on experience as the guide in the development of spiritual consciousness. That experience is more important than rationality. One uses rationality to give shape to what we get in the body of our developing experience. But they should be recognized in their proper domains. Real knowledge is based in experience, but this perspective articulated here challenges that experience. So Sri Aurobindo answers in this way, but this ground of cavil, and cavil is a trifling argument, but this ground of cavil has no great value, for the object of the mystic is self-knowledge and God-knowledge, and that can only be arrived at by an inward and not by an outward gaze. So, in other words, this argument comes from outside looking in. You can't stand from the outside and tell a person what the nature and value of his experience is. You don't have standing in that. Or, he says, it is the supreme truth of things that he seeks. And that, too, cannot be arrived at by an outward inquiry through the senses or by any scrutiny or research that founds itself on outsides and surfaces or by speculation based on the uncertain data of an indirect means of knowledge. It must come by a direct vision or contact of the consciousness with the soul and body of the truth itself, or through a knowledge by identity, by the self that becomes one with the self of things and with their truth of power and their truth of essence. So these are two different categories of experience he's talking about here. In one, it is the numinous experience where the soul confronts the greater reality or the inner reality and is then arrested and changed by that contact. The other is the merging of being, where one knows because one has become that. That is still more powerful, and that is the mystic. So the numinous and the mystic sides of spiritual experience are both included here. And the way he expresses this, becomes one with the self of things and with their truth of power and their truth of essence, this is Upanishadic. But, he writes, it is urged that the actual result of this method is not one truth common to all. There are great differences. The conclusion suggested is that this knowledge is not truth at all, but a subjective mental formation. So, in other words, if you're having spiritual experiences and there's only one reality, then all spiritual experiences should be essentially the same. So, I think he'll make quick work of that. But this objection is based on a misunderstanding of the nature of spiritual knowledge. Spiritual truth is a truth of the spirit, not a truth of the intellect, not a mathematical theorem or a logical formula. It is a truth of the infinite, one in an infinite diversity, and it can assume an infinite variety of aspects and formations. In the spiritual evolution, it is inevitable that there should be a many-sided passage and reaching to the one truth, a many-sided seizing of it. This many-sidedness is the sign of the approach of the soul to a living reality, not to an abstraction or a constructed figure of things that can be petrified into a dead or stony formula. The hard logical and intellectual notion of truth as a single idea which all must accept, one idea or system of ideas defeating all other ideas or systems, or a single limited fact or single formula of facts which all must recognize, is an illegitimate transference from the limited truth of the physical field to the much more complex and plastic field of life and mind and spirit. So the argument is categorically wrong. And in terms of one idea defeating all others, well, we can see how limited and partial those victories are even in the field of physics, because lo and behold, one theory displaces another again and again. Every century or so, we have a revolution and all of our insights are turned upside down or improved upon or added to, but substantially revised. There is no final truth of things, even in our look at material nature. Still less when we get to the plastic worlds of life, or the vivid views open to an expanded mind, or to the infinite, which is the field of the spirit. This transference has been responsible for much harm. It brings into thought narrowness, limitation, and intolerance of the necessary variation and multiplicity of viewpoints, without which there can be no totality of truth finding, and by the narrowness and limitation, much obstinacy in error. By implication, his integral view is without these specious positions and without reliance on isms of any kind. This transference, again, he's talking about this improper application of reason from one field into the spiritual field. It reduces philosophy to an endless maze of sterile disputes. Religion has been invaded by this misprision, serious mistake, and infected with creedal dogmatism, bigotry, and intolerance. The truth of the spirit is a truth of being and consciousness, and not a truth of thought. Being and consciousness, sat and chit. Mental ideas can only represent or formulate some facet, some mind-translated principle or power of it, or enumerate its aspects. But to know it, one has to grow into it and be it. Without that growing and being, there can be no true spiritual knowledge. The fundamental truth of spiritual experience is one. Its consciousness is one. Everywhere it follows the same general lines and tendencies of awakening and growth into spiritual being, for these are the imperatives of the spiritual consciousness. But also there are, based on those imperatives, numberless possibilities of variation of experience and expression. The centralization and harmonization of these possibles, but also the intensive soul following out of any line of experience are both of them necessary movements of the emerging spiritual conscious force within us, Chit Shakti. Moreover, the accommodation of mind and life to the spiritual truth, its expression in them, must vary with the mentality of the seeker, so long as he has not risen above all need of such accommodation or such limiting expression. It is this mental and vital element which has created the oppositions that still divide spiritual seekers or enter into their differing affirmations of the truth that they experience. This difference and variation is needed for the freedom of spiritual search and spiritual growth. To overpass differences is quite possible, but that is most easily done in pure experience. In mental formulation, the difference must remain until one can exceed mind altogether, and in a highest consciousness, integralize, unify, and harmonize the many-sided truth of the Spirit. So Sri Aurobindo is encouraging each developing soul to experience the One in the way that is appropriate to their nature, to see it in the way that they can, to experience it fully, vividly, change their life in terms of it. We will reconcile all possibilities of viewpoint in a larger consciousness when we integralize our experience in a higher realm, in the supramental awareness. In the evolution of the spiritual man, there must necessarily be many stages, and in each stage, a variety of individual formations of the being, the consciousness, the life, the temperament, the ideas, the character. The nature of instrumental mind and the necessity of dealing with the life must of itself create an infinite variety according to the stage of development and the individuality of the seeker. But apart from that, even the domain of pure spiritual self-realization and self-expression need not be a single white monotone. There can be a great diversity in the fundamental unity. The Supreme Self is one, but the souls of the self are many. And as is the soul's formation of nature, so will be its spiritual self-expression. A diversity in oneness is the law of the manifestation. The supramental unification and integration must harmonize these diversities. But to abolish them is not the intention of the spirit in nature. So this setting of our course and recognizing that we go through many stages is true both of society and of the self. And we proceed first from experience and then diffuse those experiences among our many perspectives into theories, which have their day, then have their passing. But the ultimate is an experience of a gathered oneness in which all these perspectives are harmonized. We will not say any true insight, any deep sounding of the nature of the Spirit is wrong. Let us invite every experience into the largest experience. Let us integrate. Let us harmonize in oneness. So Sri Aurobindo closes the evolution of the spiritual man with that phrase. But to abolish them is not the intention of the spirit in nature. We are not to move away from the world. We are to realize it all here in the world. Ihaiva, here and now, this very moment, this very life. Next week, we'll be in a new year in 2018, and we'll move from these various theories into chapter 25, the triple transformation, where philosophy becomes yoga, where the individual becomes wedded to nature and to the all. . 2017, we kiss you goodbye. Tonight we close with a section from Savitri. In Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. A grand solution closed the long impasse in which the heights of mortal effort end. A reconciling wisdom looked on life. It took the striving undertones of mind and took the confused refrain of human hopes and made of them a sweet and happy call. It lifted from an underground of pain the inarticulate murmur of our lives and found for it a sense illimitable, a mighty oneness, its perpetual theme. It caught the soul's faint, scattered utterances, read hardly twixt our lines of rigid thought, or mid this drowse and coma on matter's breast, heard like disjointed mutterings in sleep. It grouped the golden links that they had lost and showed to them their divine unity, saving from the error of divided self the deep spiritual cry in all that is. All the great words that toiled to express the One were lifted into an absoluteness of light, an ever-burning revelation's fire, and the immortality of the eternal voice. There was no quarrel more of truth with truth. The endless chapter of their differences, retold in light by an omniscient scribe, traveled through difference towards unity. Mind's winding search lost every tinge of doubt, led to its end by an all-seeing speech that garbed the initial and original thought with the finality of an ultimate phrase. United were time's creative mood and tense to the style and syntax of identity. A paean swelled from the lost musing deeps. An anthem pealed to the triune ecstasies, a cry of the moments to the immortal's bliss. As if the strophes of a cosmic ode, a hierarchy of climbing harmonies peopled with voices and with visages, aspired in a crescendo of the gods from matter's abysses to the spirit's peaks. Above were the immortals' changeless seats, white chambers of dalliance with eternity, and the stupendous gates of the alone. Across the unfolding of the seas of self appeared the deathless countries of the One. A many-miracled consciousness unrolled vast aim and process and unfettered norms, a larger nature's great familiar roads. Affranchised from the net of earthly sense, Calm continents of potency were glimpsed. Homelands of beauty shut to human eyes, half seen at first through wonder's gleaming lids, surprised the vision with felicity. Sunbelts of knowledge, moonbelts of delight, stretched out in an ecstasy of widenesses beyond our indigent corporeal range. There he could enter, there a while abide. A voyager upon uncharted routes, fronting the viewless danger of the unknown, adventuring across enormous realms, he broke into another space and time. End of Canto 5. End of Book 1. End of 2017. Some of us present are already in 2018. Namaste. Jai Ma.